From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. Today, Homeland Security agents are detaining protesters in Portland, and some worry Detroit could be next.
And this should get every one of ours attention about where our country might be headed. And we have to stand up for the very fundamental pillars of our Constitution.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell joins us. Also, the story of a woman known as Detroit's other Rosa Parks.
Sarah was forcibly walked off the Bablo boat SS Columbia, and she called the NAACP.
And we'll talk about the drumbeat of eviction that hammers down on renters.
We don't find people who are just waiting and not trying to put any effort. They're really putting an effort trying to see, what can I do to stop this eviction from happening?
Those conversations today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, sitting in for April Baer. Today, we'll talk about how systemic racism reaches easily into the housing sector with the slow drowning of renters caught in a riptide of eviction.
People were stopping to pick through his things with him sitting there. And he was just so overwhelmed with telling people to stop. This is my stuff. He was just beaten down at that point in time.
That conversation later on the program. But first, President Trump alarmed states across the nation yesterday with the suggestion that he will send Homeland Security agents into more American cities. This after numerous reports of heavily armed agents detaining protesters in Portland, Oregon, throwing them into unmarked vehicles and arresting them without warrant. Now the president has listed Detroit as a city he is considering for deployment of these ICE agents. Here he is speaking in the Oval Office.
Well, I'm going to do something that I can tell you, because we're not going to let New York and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit and Baltimore and all of these, Oakland is a mess. We're not going to let this happen in our country, so all run by liberal Democrats.
More federal law enforcement to some of these cities?
More federal law enforcement, that I can tell you. In Portland, they've done a fantastic job. They've been there 3 days, and they really have done a fantastic job in a very short period of time. No problem.
That news was surprising to state and city officials, who point out that protests in Detroit have been, by and large, peaceful. Does the president have a right to send agents into a city with no provocation? For answers, we turn to one of our representatives from Southeast Michigan, Congresswoman Debbie Dingell. Congresswoman, welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you.
So what do we know about the validity or seriousness of Trump's suggestion that Homeland Security will descend on Detroit?
So I take anything that the president says seriously, and I think it is absolutely outrageous. I am so upset. It's just deeply disturbing that he is once again trying to interfere with the fundamental pillars of our Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, due process, freedom of press. All of those things are constantly under attack. There's no reason for the president to have to send in troops into our city, in the city of Detroit. I don't live there, but I was born there and I still call it my city. The fact of the matter is we have a right to freedom of speech. There isn't a violent protest going on every day. People have been speaking up. They've been present peacefully and respectfully. That's what America's about. The ability to have freedom of speech, to stand up for what is right. And in this week of John Lewis's death, my dear friend, the president should be respecting what he taught us. It's okay to get into good trouble. And the president has no right to send in unmarked vans, secret police to threaten us. I would encourage him to stay away.
Congressman Justin Amash from West Michigan, a libertarian, called the move by the president tyranny. Regardless of how it reads, is it legal?
Well, he can, I guess, if he tried to invoke an executive order. But trust me, that every last one of us will be in the courts pushing back if he does try to do that. You know, I said in my Facebook posting this morning, it really does. It reminds me of a movie about gulags or about the Soviet Union. This is America. This is where we have a democracy. Secret police is not something that any American in this country should fear. And this should get every one of ours attention about where our country might be headed, and we have to stand up for the very fundamental pillars of our Constitution.
Is it clear what legal recourse or grounds state officials might have to change the course?
I really do believe that this can be fought out in the courts. I think people can't believe that in this day and age, we are having to think about this. But this ACLU has already filed a couple of civil suits and will continue to. But we all will be doing congressional investigations. We're asking questions. Nobody can believe that we're having to ask these questions and have these oversight hearings and hold him accountable. But the most important thing that everybody can do right now is, if you are worried, which I deeply am, about the direction that this takes us and things that I never thought that I would see in this country, a secret police going into our major cities, it reinforces the importance of our November election more than ever.
You represent Dearborn, and Dearborn is not unfamiliar with ICE agents coming into the city with seeming lack of provocation in a post-9/11 world. What lessons are there to be learned about the authority or process that plays out between citizens arrested without warrant by Homeland Security agents?
Well, I think this is, you know, they will do that in the name of national security. And there are multiple times that we have had pushback, go into the courts, ask questions, change laws. Tomorrow in the House of Representatives, by the way, we will be voting to repeal the Muslim ban. I'll be sitting in the chair for that two-hour debate. And then Rashida Tlaib will be sitting in the chair for the vote itself. And we have had to fight this in the courts and have won some major battles in the court. This is even beyond the pale that what we're looking going into our cities right now, where people are having peaceful demonstrations. They're standing up for what they think is right. We did this in the 60s on both the Civil Rights Bill, but the Vietnam War. And I think people need to really reflect about what this means. And I agree with Justin Amash. I think this is very close to tyranny. And we need to make sure that we never become a country that is like Russia or China.
Is this an extrapolation of a problem potentially created by Congress in the first place with the war on terror being approved to sort of give the president unilateral decision making on what is in the interest of national security?
You know, this is a very dangerous road that we are on. I am someone who has recommended and believes strongly that we need to revisit those initial laws that were passed on FISA. We probably have created some of this ourselves. You know, and I remember, quite frankly, I'll be your candid. When I was a brand new member and President Obama was still president, it was a vote in November, which was a Muslim ban of sorts. It would have banned visas for several Mideast countries. And we do need to worry about our national security. We need to walk that fine line of how do we protect our national security and at the same time protect our liberties and our freedoms that our forefathers, should have been women, but they weren't, fought very hard to protect. What is the old line? Those who would give up liberty for security deserve neither. We are at that time. So I do want to keep our country safe. But I also think we are crossing over dangerous lines. We've been looking at rolling back some of those crossing lines, or how are we more transparent? How do we protect people's individual freedoms and liberties? Hopefully this, when President Obama was going to do the travel ban, many Democrats voted for that. I was one of 17 that opposed it and said to many people that day, What are you doing? Are you thinking about this? And we let that fear at times override protecting our individual freedoms and liberties.
Do you think that was because of your personal experience or intimate knowledge of your district that includes Dearborn?
I know it was because I deal with this. I mean, I've lived in Dearborn for 25 years. My neighbors have been subject to some very difficult profiling situations that have occurred. Arab Americans are doctors and nurses and pharmacists and teachers, business people. They're part of our community. And they get stigmatized just because they're Muslims. We need to respect everybody's religious and cultural background. You know, I always say to people, you make assumptions, but quite frankly, still to this day, one of the most horrific acts of terror that occurred in this country was in Oklahoma City, and that was done by the Michigan militia from Michigan. So we had to be very careful in prejudging anybody and protecting all people's freedoms.
I wanted to spend the last couple minutes with you talking about John Lewis. You've known him for a long time. What memories of Congressman Lewis have you been reflecting on these past couple days?
I've been reflecting on a lot. It's hard for me. I miss him. He was a wonderful friend. John Dingell and he knew each other for decades. And they fought for civil rights together. And when he came to the Congress, John Dingell mentored John Lewis. And then John Lewis became a rock for me. And when John died, he gave the eulogy. And he knew how hard it was for me and was just always there. So I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking about the last time I saw him, which was a few weeks ago, he had seen a picture of me lying down on the ground in Allen Park with the young people in memory of George Floyd. And he told me he was proud of me. He told me to listen to them, to help guide them, and to remember to always have hope and remember to get in good trouble. I think good trouble is the word I'll always think of when I think of John Lewis. And he taught us to stand up when we saw something that was wrong, to get into good trouble, but to never hate, to always have hope, to have hope for the future. And he dreamed of the day that people would come together and be one community in one America.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell is a Democrat who represents Michigan's 12th congressional district. Congresswoman Dingell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we learn about Sarah Elizabeth Ray and the forgotten story behind integrating the Bablo boats.
I mean, she was the Rosa Parks of the Bablo boat, and nobody knew about her. Nobody talked about her.
That conversation after the break. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. For many Michiganders, summer used to include a stopover on Bablo Island in the Detroit River. Trips to the amusement park island ended in the early 1990s, but folks still talk about carefree days on Bablo or riding one of the two Bablo boats, the Columbia and the St. Clair. Those two boats are the subject of a documentary underway, Bablo Boats, A Tale of Two Sisters. Within that documentary is the story of a woman named Sarah Elizabeth Ray, a woman hailed as Detroit's other Rosa Parks for her experience on the Bablo boats. Here to tell us more about Sarah Elizabeth Ray is Aaron Schillinger, the filmmaker behind the Bablo Boats documentary. Aaron, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
And Desiree, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so what is it, Desiree, about Bablo Island that still resonates with Detroiters and people from the area who were able to visit?
You know, I think Bablo means summer. It just like that excursion that everyone could do. It was a common Detroit experience. And I have to make a true confession. I never went to Bablo.
What?
I know. I moved to Detroit in 1984. And I think it closed shortly after
right.
I moved into the area.
Yep.
And so I never had that experience. And yet I feel nostalgic about it because so many people have so many fond memories of going to Bablo.
Not dissimilar to riding the train in the zoo or perhaps taking the tram into Disney World. It was this way that you were literally transported to a different place.
Exactly.
So let's then talk about Sarah Elizabeth Ray, who had a harder time than those of us who are living and experienced Bablo as young kids, had a harder time getting there. How did you first hear about Sarah Elizabeth Ray?
So in 2006, I was a columnist for the Detroit Free Press, and I often got wacky doodle calls from people saying, have I got a story for you? I got one of those calls. The guy sounded a little off kilter to me, like way too urgent, a little scattered. And he's like, you've got to come and meet this woman, you know, Sarah Elizabeth Ray. She's famous. She did so much for Detroit and nobody remembers who she is. And I'm like, okay, whatever. He called me a couple times and I said, okay, let me go check this out. And when I did, and I got to her house, it was sort of like in that moment, I was realizing what was happening. That I, of course, had done some research ahead of time, and his allegations panned out that she had indeed integrated the Bablo boat. I mean, she was the Rosa Parks of the Bablo boat. And nobody knew about her. Nobody talked about her. And when I found her, she was very, very old, very, very thin, gaunt. It was February. Her house was cold. I don't know if she had electricity. She said she wanted to offer me something, but didn't have anything. So I don't even know if she had food. You know, I was worried about her. You know, she was completely forgotten by Detroit.
Desiree, you say in the film she was. It was clear to you she was a forgotten person. Did she feel that way?
That is a good question. I think she did feel that way because of the eagerness with which she let me into her home to tell her story. She was very anxious to kind of get it out and make sure at least one more person knew about it. I'd have to say, more than that, I felt as she was talking that she was still on that pier. You know what I mean? Like time had sort of frozen in that moment. It was a moment she was never, ever going to forget. And Laura, not only was I not on the Bablo boat, she never went on the Bablo boat.
She never got on it.
She never got on the boat.
Wow.
And that was a point of principle for her.
Oh, because of the initial rejection.
Yep.
So let's talk about that day. Aaron, recount for me what happened exactly when Sarah decided she was going to get on this boat.
Sure. Well, this was back in 1945 when you used to get on the Bablo boat at the foot of Woodward Avenue. And she was with her graduating class. They were graduating from secretarial school. And she was the only African American in the group. And the teacher had actually purchased the tickets. So Sarah was able to kind of slip into the crowd of her white classmates without really being noticed that much. I think she talked about the purser noticing the color of her hand. And so then Sarah was on the boat with her classmates celebrating when she was asked to leave. She refused at first, and then her teacher said, she'll go quietly, which that line to me just stings so much. It just feels like such a terrible way to treat somebody who, you know, you're supposed to be celebrating with them, and then you just throw them to the dogs, you know? And so then Sarah was forcibly walked off the Bablo boat SS Columbia, where she was refunded her money. And she told Desiree that she threw her change back at the boat. It was 85 cents, which was worth a lot of money back in 1945. But she didn't want to keep the change. And she called the NAACP. And that's when she started her fight, which would last about 3 years, which would go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where she would win and Bablo Island would be integrated.
Aaron, when did you know that this was an important story to document in the film version of her story?
In 2015, I started working on a full-length documentary called Bablo Boats, A Tale of Two Sisters, where we were following the restoration of the two Bablo boats, the St. Clair and the SS Columbia. And I was doing some research into the history because that's all we're following present day people, but we're also looking at the history. And there was a little blurb on Sarah in a history book on Bablo. And then it just kind of mentioned that the park closed the next year. And it just felt like there was a lot more to that story. And when I researched online to try to find more articles, there wasn't much. Then about a year later, suddenly I found Desiree Cooper's article. And that's when I learned about the connection to Thurgood Marshall and also her case's broader implications in ending segregation in public schools.
Desiree, this happened 75 years ago, which isn't as long ago as we'd like to think that this encounter would have happened. Talk a bit about what Detroit would have looked like and felt like, you know, just a few weeks or months after VE Day.
One thing that people don't realize is Detroit has had a long history of racial strife. It didn't all start in 67. And so in 43, there was actually a race riot on Belle Isle. And it was part of sort of a national conflict around integrating amusement areas and amusement parks. And so Detroit was not unusual in that regard, but it was kind of was in the bulkhead of the integration movement because whites definitely wanted their precious, pristine leisure places. And people of color were trying to get access to those places, even though they had forged, many had forged their own kind of idyllic places, like Idyllwild, Michigan, for example. So I think Sarah's case was very much part of that rolling history around how these amusement and recreational areas were going to be integrated. And so that is also part of the larger import of Sarah's story. One reason that this story happened successfully is because Michigan was one of the few states that had its own Civil Rights Act and prohibited discrimination based on race in public accommodations. And that is something that most states did not have. So even though Sarah's case went to the Supreme Court and she won, it did not automatically integrate all amusement parks. It just affirmed that you could not do that in Michigan.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Aaron Schillinger. He's a filmmaker working on a documentary about the Bablo Island boats, and also Desiree Cooper. She's a writer originally from Detroit. The timing of it isn't lost on me in that we would have just emerged as a country victorious from the European theater in World War II, and Black Americans in Detroit would have been the engine that powered the movement to create all these machines that were used by the government to win that war. Was there a sense of her timing that you can't just push the Black Detroiters that were still there, you can't just push them back into a box? They have been at the forefront of the arsenal of democracy, that they got the country through its most desperate moments, and that you can't just say, okay, we're all going back to normal. Was there a sense that the timing of this had anything to do with where Black Detroiters were as far as the war was concerned?
You know, more than that, you had the veterans coming back, you know, from Europe. So, you know, yeah, you weren't going to put them back in a box. And I do think that was part of the landscape, but I can't reiterate enough what an individual Sarah was. She had come from Tennessee. She was one of something like 11 kids. She had married and immigrated through the Great Migration to Detroit. And this is my editorializing. I think she dumped the guy almost as soon as she got to Detroit and went to secretarial school. Like, I'm going to be better. You know, I'm going to be better, and I'm here to be better. I'm here to transcend my life in Tennessee. I'm here to prove out of the 11 siblings that I'm going to be the one, you know? And she does it. She graduates. And so now she has credentials, and she's on her way. And when they ask her to get off the boat, it was certainly an insult to her as a Black woman. But it was also an insult to her as Sarah Elizabeth Ray, who is worth a lot more than that. You know, she was a little bit haughty. And I still saw that when I met her. You know, she was not an apologetic person. I think they just picked the wrong one that day.
In that context, Des, when we're talking about her as Detroit's other Rosa Parks, you're talking about some what I understand to be similarities with Rosa Parks' personality. But Rosa Parks set out to accomplish something specific, where it sort of seems that Sarah Elizabeth Ray fell into this. Would you say that's true, that she found herself in the situation rather than inserting herself?
Yeah, I do think while, you know, we talk shorthand about her being Detroit's other Rosa Parks in that she tried to sit down somewhere that was segregated and the ensuing fight changed history. Okay, so we have that is a huge comparison. But other than that, the comparisons start to fall away. I think that Rosa Parks was definitely part of a system. She had worked with the NAACP. She had worked on sexual assaults against Black women. She was already quite an activist. Her step into history was much more calculated. Sarah, like I just was saying, is, you know, they just tapped the wrong one that day. The wrong one and the right one, you know? Like they had no idea that was going to flare up. And she may have known. I mean, how could she not have known that the boat was segregated?
Right.
But she was feeling her oats and feeling entitled. And I'm sure with her white classmates around her and her teacher supporting her in her mind, she was going to get on that boat and have that party and celebrate what she had earned that day. So I think it was very much an instantaneous spark for her and much less a part of her being a system. I will say this, and Aaron has found some great documentation that might have sparked her to become part of more of a system of activism. She got involved with the communist movement and she had an action house on her street. So perhaps this was the beginning of her as a civil rights activist.
Aaron, what did you find in your research?
Yeah, back when we made the short film, there really wasn't that many pictures around her, but now I've paired up with a researcher, Des and I have paired up with a researcher whose name is also Sarah, and she's dug up some photos of Sarah, who actually changed her name to Liz Haskell when she got married to a Jewish man who was very involved organizing the labor movement in Detroit and also the socialist movement. So we found some letters and photographs. It just feels like messages from the past that Sarah's giving us that have just kind of been lost in time. So we're trying to do research to discover more about the community that she was involved in, of these like communists in the 60s and 70s in the east side of Detroit. And, you know, the stories are starting to emerge.
Did you get the sense that this Bablo boat story was at all a nexus for that trajectory?
She must have had that fight in her the whole time, because she decided when she got kicked off the boat that she was going to do something right away. And, you know, one of the interesting pictures that we found is actually a picture with her and Odetta, who was an African-American singer who was also involved in the social justice movement. So I feel like she always had this in her, if I had to guess, but I can't say for certain because we never met her.
Aaron, because we didn't have many pictures of her, one of the avenues that you pursued was stop motion animation to tell her story. How did you know that that was the direction you wanted to go rather than just you using, you know, the limited photographs that you had or, you know, some just general generic pictures of Bablo Island and the boats?
Yeah. So I worked with a stop motion animator and production designer named Beck Sloan. And when I found out that she did everything by hand, it felt like a beautiful way to give a tribute to Sarah Elizabeth Ray, who the history books had kind of glossed over. It just took hours and hours to make her puppet, and then even longer to make the set that we were going to animate her in. The fact that it was made by hand with recycled fabrics, it just felt special.
And how long did that process take of telling just a few minutes of her story in stop motion?
Well, the build time was a few months, but when we actually came down to shoot it, I and the stop motion animator and the cinematographer were basically in my bedroom for a month straight, you know, 16-hour days, maybe one day off a week if we're lucky, moving these puppets millimeter by millimeter.
Desiree, when we actually get her story in film here and now she's brought to life in this way, what are you hoping that people will take away from seeing her story played out like this?
Well, first of all, you know, especially in this moment, in this time where we are learning how cruelly miseducated we were about history, we really want Detroiters and the world to know more about the many forgotten people who brought us to this moment. And so that's huge for us. I think also Erin and I have a secret hope that more people will come forward who knew her family, knew of her, met her, so that we can round out her story. I mean, it would be amazing if we could expand the 4-minute film that we have on her now into something longer, like a 30-minute that can be used for educational purposes and historical purposes. So it's kind of a twofer. Like, we want the piece of the story that we know out there, and we want those out there to give us the rest of the story.
Erin Schillinger is the filmmaker from Sarah Elizabeth Ray, Detroit's other Rosa Parks. And Desiree Cooper is a writer from Detroit who really fell upon her story and gave it life in the newspapers. Desiree and Erin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you want to learn more or see a screening tonight of the mini documentary about Sarah Elizabeth Ray, you can check it out at detroitsotherrosaparks.com. Next up, we take a look at how evictions play out and feed into a system that disproportionately hurts Black and brown renters. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for April Baer. COVID-19 has changed a lot of what we consider to be normal, including a system of eviction that strips humanity out of interactions between renters, landlords, sheriff's departments, and the courts. Governor Gretchen Whitmer issued a moratorium on evictions that ended last week in favor of a diversion program. Earlier this year, the University of Washington released a study showing Black renters were 7 times more likely to be evicted than white renters. Here to talk about what eviction looks like for those feeling it most acutely is Bonnie Billups. He's executive director of Peace Neighborhood Center in Ann Arbor. Bonnie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What does eviction look like for the families that you come in contact with? What are the pieces that generally are a shared experience?
The shared experience is usually fear, figuring out what's going to be next, figuring out how to save what possessions you might have, figuring out how you're going to get your kids back and forth to school, especially if you're going to be living with someone else and it's out of the school district. Figuring out all those pieces, you know, that you would not have to worry about if you were had some kind of stable housing situation.
How does it happen from a sort of timeline perspective? Is it something that happens overnight, or is it something that plays, is eviction a slow process that plays out over months?
Well, it can be a slow process. It depends on how much you're in denial or how much you're working it toward making it not happen. So the process is this, is you, of course, get a letter stating that you owe the rent, you go to court, and the judge will say, okay, you need to pay by this time. So now that time clock really starts ticking, because within this amount of time, you need to, usually within 2 weeks at the most, you need to pay the landlord or you're out. And so if you're someone who, is still working every day, still trying to figure out how to come up with this amount of money so that you can maintain your housing. I mean, you're waiting to the last moment, trying to hold on to the hope that you'll come up with the money and be able to maintain your housing. That's what we find. We don't find people who are just waiting and not trying to put any effort. They're really putting an effort, trying to see what can I do to stop this eviction from happening. And then, of course, at some point, there's a notice put on your door saying you have 24 hours. And with that amount of time, law enforcement and people from the complex that you're renting from will come. And then, of course, the process of removing your stuff is not a pretty one. It's throwing all your stuff in bags and putting it on the side of the road. So those things are not pretty. But the fact that families, the stress of trying to come up with the funds and running from agency to agency or relative to relative to try to come up with the funds to be able to stay in the housing is probably, I would think, the most stressful part of the process.
I called you not long ago after I saw what was clearly a household's worth of possessions on the side of the road and wondered, did you know this family? Did you know anything about the story? Trying to get in contact with the family. And you didn't know about that particular case, but you know, you and I were discussing a little bit. There is an aspect of people descending upon those pieces of property, those memories, those pictures, those pieces of furniture. And people pick through other people's possessions, trying to find something that they might need for their own home. When you come upon a scene like that, what goes through your mind about both the items that are being lost, but also the people who gather to pick up those pieces?
Well, I can tell you a story. We had a gentleman who got evicted, and he had worked very hard to try to save his house, and he had become unemployed, and he couldn't find the resources. And they came that morning, and they put all his stuff out on the side of the road on Gulf Side. He was sitting in a chair with his possessions, with his cell phone, trying to make phone calls to get some friend with a truck or somebody with a van to come and grab the things that he wanted to keep, that he could keep. And at the same time that was happening, when we rolled up on the situation with our van to try to move some of his stuff, people were stopping to pick through his things. With him sitting there. And he was just so overwhelmed with telling people to stop. This is my stuff. He was just so overwhelmed. He was just beaten down at that point in time. So myself and another staff person got out, of course, and we were not very nice to people who were trying to pick through his stuff and tried to explain to them as forcefully as we could in a nice way that, you know, this is this man's possessions and this is all that he has left at this point in time. You know, it's not appropriate for you to be picking through things while he's there. But I mean, we have to think about the fact that whenever we walk by a pile of stuff that's sitting out, that those were once possessions of somebody. They're now homeless. The majority of those people are homeless with no place to go, or doubling up with other relatives or on the streets.
Are there any legal mechanisms that protect renters from having their lives strewn about in such a public way when they are evicted?
I don't think there's anything that I know of that stops that part of the process. There are, of course, lots of safeguards to try to stop the eviction process. I mean, there's legal things that people can do, and there's all kind of efforts of nonprofits to assist people. And there are some very great landlords who we work with that we've, you know, been able to call and say, hey, give us an extra 2 weeks while we try to find a solution for this family or for this individual. And those landlords and owners of property have been great with trying to wait to the last moment. I don't think anybody really wants to evict people, but there does come a time when I think landlords are at their wits' end, and there comes a time when families who have done everything that they can to save their housing have no other option but at that point to leave or to be evicted until they find some other solution.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Bonnie Billups. He's the executive director of Peace Neighborhood Center in Ann Arbor. Bonnie, Peace Neighborhood, you have this nice, beautiful community center, but it started in a house that's right next door to the community center. And it's still owned by Peace and serves as a rent-free home for families, one family at a time, who has been evicted or is struggling to get their feet back underneath them. When did the organization know that this would be an important part of the mission and this would be the use for the facility?
Yeah, that program is called Peace House, Peace Transitional House. And it's two units. There's an upstairs unit and a downstairs unit. Thus far, we've had, I think, 19 families go through Peace House. Reason that we started Peace House was because we had a family, a young lady and her siblings who had been evicted three times in a 2-year period. The mom was very successful at talking a landlord into letting them move into a house. And she was worked hard, but she had 5 kids and they needed a larger space. And most of the time she could handle part of the rent, but not all the rent. So it would take 6 or 8 months before she would get an eviction notice. And within, you know, 10 months or so, they would be evicted again. And they would have to go back into a situation where there was domestic violence and until she could find another place. And that situation, we realized that if she had had a place where she could live more than 90 days, where she could work at saving money, where she could work at being able to work at advancement in her job or find the right job that would pay her enough money, or even have the luxury of finding the right housing that she could afford, as opposed to signing something that she knew in her heart of hearts she wasn't going to be able to do, but just so that she could have a spot for her kid. If all those things could be met, what would that look like? And that's how we developed Peace House. We went to all of the local shelters and spoke with all of the directors and staff there. And the model that we came up with a situation where people could stay up to a year, that there is a mandatory savings of their funds, that we don't charge anybody rent or anything, that we help to alleviate the problems that put people in chronic housing crisis. Things like fixing credit reports, like giving people a chance to work a job and get an advancement in that job, working out transportation issues, child care, all of those things that are barriers to, or things that help to create housing crisis is what Peace House was designed to help alleviate. And we can only do 2 families at a time. And those families end up staying sometimes, the average stay is about 9 to 10 months. But we had one family that stayed 2.5 years if we'd worked on very closely with them on an IRS problem, and they had been in a hotel for 3 years. But that family moved out and has been successful, as with other 17 families. So 18 families total have moved out and been extremely successful and not had any reoccurrence of housing crisis in their lives.
What is that? Essentially, now what you have built up a series of experiences and data, what does it tell you about the ability to stem the tide of evictions?
Yeah, it tells us that the key is to work on the real issue that creates the housing crisis, which makes people get evicted. And so we find that a lot of times those things are, like I said earlier, are centered around jobs, around parenting issues, around the ability to have transportation to get to a job, the ability to create or to fix things on your credit report so that you can actually move into a housing situation that is fair and not held as a threat over you. Because sometimes the fear is, I have to take this place and it's not where I really want to live, but it's the only place that'll accept me with my credit history. But I know it's not a good place for me to be or for my family to be. So, you know, sort of addressing those issues are the things that we found are the things that make people have long-term success. From our discussions with some of the other shelter programs, family shelters and domestic abuse and individual shelters, the discussion was sometimes 90 days is not enough. A lot of them have restrictions of 90 days and then you need to move on. But that's not enough to fix a systemic real problem that keeps causing a lot of housing crisis.
So Peace is in a generally affluent white community. And a lot of your work focuses on families struggling to make ends meet in the community, many of them Black and brown. How does that disparity sit with you?
I grew up in Ann Arbor. I moved here when I was 8 years of age. And so this has been a community that I'm very invested in, And it's a wonderful city and a wonderful place to live. Washtenaw County is a wonderful place to live. But we know that there's some disparities as far as economics and race, and that what I feel on a daily basis might be different from my white male friends. And so I feel that we all have a lot of work to do, that this community is open to these kind of discussions and trying to figure out what's the next steps. But, you know, we have a lot of work to do. And I think everybody needs to look at the whole thing of implicit bias that we might have and how to address it and to make ourselves aware of all of those things.
As we continue or see this surge in a national dialogue about systemic racism, what is rising to your mind about what you think some of the most important things for people to know are?
I think the first thing to realize is, and to, you know, and I remind myself of regularly, that we're only 50 years into the Civil Rights Act of this country. It's not like this country has forever had laws or ways to support equality. And so the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, those things were just in the 60s. So, and this country has, you know, a history of hundreds of years. And most of those hundreds of years were not pleasant years for people of color. And so we're really in our infancy of trying to bring real equality to all people in this country and to live up to the Declaration of Independence. My hope is that in my grandkids' lifetime, that, you know, as we've seen progress in my lifetime, that by the time my grandkids have kids, that we would have solved this issue of race and economic and class differences. And that the United States would even be would really be an example to the rest of the world of how it's done.
You also serve a great population of youth and kids. When you work with them, you yourself as a youth or as a teen went through Peace Neighborhood Center in the 1970s. What do you think about the power to, I don't know, change a generational response? You're talking about just a few decades that you've been talking about. People, I guess what I'm trying to say is like that the way that people feel about their society around them sort of shifts on a generational basis. So if that holds true, what do you see in the kids that are coming up right now and their ability to process where we are in American history?
Despite some of the negative things, I see a lot of hope. I see a lot of great possibilities. I see the foundations for change. I see and believe that we will get to that point that we're supposed to be, of the oneness of all human beings and oneness of humanity. And I feel that, I know that, and I see that with the kids that I work with and the kids who I come across. But I think it's important for them to understand the historical context of things so that they, as they grow to be leaders and they grow to be the adults in this community, and they grow to be the people who are sitting at Thanksgiving dinner with their families, that they can correct the ignorance of their older aunts and uncles and grandparents and help to guide them toward this new complete love for humanity the way it should be.
Bonnie Billups, Executive Director of Peace Neighborhood Center in Ann Arbor. Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. I'm Laura Weber Davis. Thanks so much for joining us. See you tomorrow.